Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 2nd of April, these are our main stories. Protesters in Israel give their answer to Benjamin Netanyahu delaying his controversial judicial reforms. In their tens of thousands, they say it's not enough. The abbot of the most important monastery in Ukraine has appeared in court, accused of backing Russia. Also,
we just published a study that showed that there was an increase in anti-Semitism since he took over. It nearly doubled. That's both an increase in the anti-Semitic accounts that have been created, but also anti-Semitic hate speech itself.
A disturbing growing trend on Twitter since Elon Musk bought it. Plus, in this podcast, heavy security in Bihar in India after violence erupts during religious processions in other parts of the country. And the BBC World Service initiative to educate girls in Afghanistan who are banned from going to school by the Taliban. We start in Israel, where huge crowds chanted democracy on the streets of Israel's biggest city, Tel Aviv. Saturday evening's protests will have left the country's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, in little doubt about the strength of feeling among those who fear his proposals to reform the judiciary threaten the very roots of Israeli democracy. I heard the latest from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Joel Greenberg.
I'd say in Jerusalem there were several thousand, but news reports are saying that in Tel Aviv there were over 150,000 and there were tens of thousands in other locations around the country. So I think in general we can say that the protests are continuing. The mood in Jerusalem was basically keeping a watchful eye on the government. The prime minister here has put this judicial overhaul plan on hold to allow for talks with the opposition for about a month until parliament comes back from its recess, actually at the end of April. But the mood at this demonstration was that they don't quite trust the government. And this protest was being held outside the president's residence, which is where these compromise talks are going on. And the protesters were basically saying that they're keeping an eye on the government. And if the government picks up where it's left off, they're going to be in for more protests.
Because these protests have gone on for weeks already, haven't they?
Yes, this is actually the 13th consecutive Saturday night weekly protest around the country since this whole campaign began. And there was some speculation that after Prime Minister Netanyahu put this plan on hold, the plan to weaken the Supreme Court and overhaul the judicial system, that maybe the protests would wither away or there would be fewer people. But it seems that the protesters feel that they need to continue being heard on the streets, so the outcome will be one that they find acceptable.
And Joel, you live there. I mean, how is this feeding into everyday life in Israel?
Well, I think for many people, it's unusual for such large protests to happen. I mean, there really have been quite huge protests. And what I see and hear from people I know and also in the press and reporting is that a lot of people who normally would not go out to protest are finding themselves going out on Saturday night to take part in these demonstrations because there's a widespread feeling among those people that the very essence of the democratic system in Israel is under threat. That this goes beyond just regular politics right and left. It's an attempt, as they see it, an attempt by the government to change the government system in a way that will weaken the Supreme Court, weaken the court's oversight over the government and parliament, and change the nature of Israel as a democratic country. So I think this has mobilized a lot more people than the usual political causes.
Joel Greenberg in Jerusalem. Not for the first time, religion has been drawn into Ukraine's war with Russia. The Russian Orthodox Church has supported Moscow's invasion of its neighbour, so it's vital for Kyiv that the Ukrainian branch of Orthodox Christianity, which once looked to Moscow, is seen as separate and loyal. But President Zelensky's government is suspicious, and now the abbot from Ukraine's most important Orthodox monastery has appeared in court. Metropolitan Pavel is accused of justifying Russia's armed aggression, a charge he denies. During the day, people gathered outside the monastery in Kyiv. A supporter of the abbot said he'd been falsely accused.
Тому що сьогодні багато неправди говорять на них, багато Today, many lie. They slander them. They deceive. We came to support them and express our position regarding this. We are accused of being an agent of the Kremlin, accused of being Moscow supporters, that we send money there and the like. Many lie.
But also, there was this critic of the abbot.
Let's hope that the authorities will be able to imprison him and bring him to justice for collaboration in spreading negative influence on people. Let's hope he will just be kicked out and that's it.
I heard more from our correspondent in Kyiv, Hugo Bachega.
Metropolitan Pavlo, who is a senior cleric of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, he was arrested today. He's been detained. And the Ukrainian security forces are accusing him of inciting religious hatred, of justifying the invasion of Ukraine. These are allegations that he denies. And the authorities are saying that they've gathered evidence from his public speeches, also intercepted communications to support those accusations. I think what's happening here, the heart of everything, is that this is the church that had ties with the Russian Orthodox Church. The church here in Ukraine broke those ties last year following the invasion of Ukraine. The church in Moscow has been openly supporting the invasion here. But the Ukrainians believe that some senior members of the church have continued to support Moscow. So there has been dozens of clerics and high-level officials being investigated. Some of them have been charged with possible crimes related to those accusations. The church denies those claims, but we're seeing today another development in this investigation.
And Hugo, how important is the Orthodox Church in life in Ukraine?
Well, it's very important. It's the most important religion here in Ukraine. And I think what's happening now has exposed divisions among the Orthodox community here. And I was earlier this week at the Lavra here, the monastery, the most important Orthodox monastery here in the country. It dates back to the 11th century. And many followers of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church believe that they're being targeted by the government because the monks, the students, everybody who lives there, they've been told to evacuate the buildings.
Hugo Bachega. 7 months ago in Iran, a young Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini, died after being arrested and accused of not wearing her headscarf or hijab correctly. Her death sparked protests which have only recently begun to die down. Headscarves are back in the news, with the government announcing that it's determined to enforce the wearing of the hijab for women, despite all the protests. But, as Param Gabadi told us, the government is having trouble enforcing its will.
What we see is happening today in Iran is that many, many women in big cities like in Tehran and in other major cities, they just walk around on the streets without headscarf and without hijab. And by without hijab, it's not only headscarf, it's also a kind of trench coat that for four decades Iranian women had to wear in order to walk on the street. So now we see especially younger women walking on the streets without any sort of hijab, and that has frustrated Iranian hardliners. So Iranian regime is in a really difficult position because they have this tiny margin of supporters that are hardliners. And these are the people who are willing to pick up arms and defend the regime. Now, they are extremely angry seeing women on the streets of Iran without wearing headscarf. For example, a video surfaced social media yesterday and it went viral. There are two young women just standing in a grocery shop and an Iranian hardliner walks in and gets into a kind of argument with them and picks up a bottle of yogurt and hits them in the head. This has frustrated many Iranians. Scenes like that are extremely dangerous for Iranian regime as well because protests started 7 months ago and it went on for about 6 months. So does Iranian regime really want to start another wave of protests? Iranian regime in the battle with young Iranian women has technically lost, and there's no sign that Iranian women are backing off to wear the headscarf again.
Param Gabadi. Security has been stepped up in parts of the eastern Indian state of Bihar following tensions between Hindus and Muslims. Vehicles and properties were damaged in clashes during religious processions marking the Hindu festival of Ram Navami. With more details, here's our South Asia editor, Anbarasan Ethanarjan.
Huge crowds have been marking the Hindu festival of Ram Navami by waving saffron flags and swords and dancing to loud music as they marched through cities and towns across India. Some rallies were disrupted by groups of people throwing stones at each other and setting fire to vehicles. Muslims say their properties and places of worship were deliberately targeted by mobs, but Hindu right-wing groups have blamed the minority Muslims of triggering the violence. Dozens of people have been arrested in the states of West Bengal, Maharashtra and Gujarat. Commentators say increasingly assertive religious processions are creating new fault lines in India.
And Barisan Etharajan. On Saturday, Twitter removed the blue ticks used to verify many high-profile accounts. Some organisations, like the BBC, will be protected going forward, but many users will now be required to pay a subscription fee for a blue tick. Twitter says the new system will help deal with false information and trolling. Jory Craig is from the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, a think tank that researches extremism and disinformation. Amal Rajan asked her if she's persuaded by Elon Musk's explanation about why this change is needed.
Absolutely not. We're not persuaded, and we don't have any evidence that these changes will make the problem of disinformation or automated accounts or impersonation any better. In fact, we have plenty of evidence that suggests it'll make it worse.
Why?
In part because if you just imagine that the blue check mark is how people knew that their information was trusted on Twitter, if you imagine taking that away all at once, no less on April Fool's Day, you imagine a scenario where people really aren't sure what they can trust, and you have a ton of evidence that impersonator accounts will increase and that people will have to work extra hard to understand what they are understanding is true, whether that's coming from the person it says it's coming from. And we already had a broken down trust environment when it came to our information online. So for that reason, and for a whole other reasons that have to do with what changes Twitter has made so far to, for example, giving data to researchers so we can understand what's going on and other things like that, we don't have much evidence that this is going to be a change for the better.
So what does Elon Musk say to your position?
In my opinion, most of what Elon Musk is saying is performative. He would like to have people see his actions as great equalizing forces. But in reality, that's not what is occurring. If you look at the increases in, say, anti-Semitism since he has taken over the platform, in hate speech, it's pretty profound. And as we know, he's gutted the trust and safety teams that normally would deal with things like that. So whatever he would say, it would be a bit of a performance, and we would have to work hard to figure out what actual actions were behind his speech.
Hang on, is that actually the case? Is there evidence that there has been a growth in, for instance, anti-Semitism since he took over?
Yes, ISD and CASM just published a study.
ISD being Institute for Strategic Dialogue, where you work, yeah.
Exactly. We just published a study that showed that there was an increase in anti-Semitism since he took over. It nearly doubled. That's both an increase in the anti-Semitic accounts that have been created, but also anti-Semitic hate speech itself.
Most people aren't on Twitter, you know. Journalists are an awful lot, and it has this outsized influence on the media because a lot of journalists are on there. For most people who aren't on Twitter and whose relationship with the news is, it's something they dip into often quite passively. How is this going to affect them, do you think?
Well, the information that we consume on and offline is really an ecosystem. So each of these platforms inform the other. And as you say, because journalists and what in public opinion research we would call opinion elite or high news consumption individuals are on the platform, it will inevitably affect the way we are seeing TV, we are hearing radio, because these journalists and these reporters are using Twitter in many cases to inform what they're putting out there. Now, that said, it's unfortunate that Elon Musk doesn't have much action and truth behind what he's saying, because it is the case that, as you suggested, journalists and sometimes opinion elite are the people on Twitter, and it can sometimes be disconnected from where everyone else is getting their information. However, his changes do not suggest that there will be any sort of increase in trust or increase in transparency between the two audiences or between the platform and its users. So it's unfortunate that that equalizing won't be happening, because we could see and benefit from more information reaching more people at any given time.
Jory Craig of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Since the BBC was founded more than 100 years ago, its stated goal has been to inform, educate and entertain. With that in mind, the BBC World Service is launching a new programme for teenage girls in Afghanistan who are banned by the Taliban from attending school. It'll be available on BBC's Persian TV channel, Pashto and Dari Facebook pages, and on the radio, FM and shortwave. Shazia Haya is one of the presenters.
A telephone call from Afghanistan. I'm 14 years old and I'm banned from going to school. Every morning I go to the rooftop of our home to watch the primary school girls going to school. I stay there until midday when they finish, and I cry. I miss learning new things. Since the Taliban took power in August 2021, Afghan girls beyond primary school have been kept out of the classroom. The Taliban says its ban on girls going to school is only temporary. For those not able to go to class, the BBC is offering a new way for them to keep up their studies with the launch of a new educational program on TV and radio.
I'm now opening the studio door. Most of the time, BBC uses this studio to produce news content. But we temporarily change it to make it look like a school library or a school classroom.
The program is called Dars, meaning lesson in Dari and Pashto, the two most widely spoken languages in Afghanistan. The show will teach English.
My name's Phil.
بیایید این جمله رو بشکنیم.
Maths, science, history and sharing inspiring stories from across the world. For the presenters, who are all journalists with the BBC's Afghan service, this is a very personal project. Alia Farzan is one of them.
My father was a teacher before he was killed in a suicide bomb attack. Actually, he wanted me to be a journalist, but I wanted to be a teacher and follow my father's step. So by joining in this program, I think that I have fulfilled both my father's dream and also my own dream.
Like the other presenters, she was evacuated from Afghanistan to the UK after the Taliban took over in 2021. But she stays in close touch with those back home.
I speak to Afghan girls every day. They cannot seek education anymore. So by doing this program, I think that I can help those people.
Salam. Zoya Shazia Sangarwalim.
Whether on TV, online, or listening on the BBC Afghan Service radio, for those unable to go to school, classes will now come to them at home.
Shazia Haya. Still to come, Dungeons and Dragons, a game, a film, and even therapy.
There seems to be some magic when we give a client a character sheet and they get to role play as their character. They have that little bit of distance, and that seems to just really create this space.
For a few short years at the end of the 1950s, Syria and Egypt joined together to form the United Arab Republic. Their capitals were separated by 1,000 kilometres and the State of Israel. But all that seemed a minor matter at what was arguably the high watermark of Arab nationalism. More recently, relations have been much frostier, especially since the start of the civil war in Syria in 2011. But on Saturday came significant signs of a thaw as the two countries' foreign ministers met for talks in Cairo. I asked our Arab affairs analyst Sebastian Usher, why now?
This has been something that's been building momentum, and it's particularly built up since the terrible tragedy that happened in February, the earthquake that hit Turkey and, of course, the north of Syria as well. People who are uncharitable, understandably, about the motives of President Assad's regime would say that they are using this as a way of getting more leverage with other Arab states. So there's been a flurry of trips. President Assad, who at one time didn't leave Damascus for years and years, now he's started to do that more recently, but we've seen him make two trips since the earthquake, one with his wife, Asma, to Abu Dhabi, where he was warmly greeted by the leader of Abu Dhabi, who basically said that it was time to end Syria's isolation. Egypt is obviously showing that it is with this. The aim of it is to bring Syria back out of isolation, but also, one day, I suppose, to bring it back into the Arab League, from which it was kicked out in 2011.
Do we know what was specifically on the agenda in this meeting?
I think it's more the fact that you saw the warm embrace between the two foreign ministers as the Syrian foreign minister arrived. You saw just a sense that this is normal diplomacy that's going on. So, of course, they discussed the usual things, you know, security, mutual interests. But, I mean, nothing is going to come out of that right now that is going to shift the dial particularly. I mean, there are demands from both sides. Those demands that it appears have come from the Arab side, particularly spearheaded by the Gulf, are quite strong ones. They want Syria to move away from the axis of Iran. they want Syria to stop this incredible rise in drug production, particularly Captagon, a form of amphetamine that's very popular in the Gulf. We want to do far more about that, and even want potentially to put Arab forces there rather than any other to try and ensure that the peace such as it is lasts and to get the 3 million or so Syrians who've left beginning to return in a safe way. None of which President Assad is likely to do in the short term, but this is real politic. At one point, Arab states took a principled stand. They felt that President Assad had committed terrible crimes against his people. That's gone, really. He's no longer a pariah there. And the other element of this is not just how it's moving in the Arab world, but will this affect how the US looks at this in the West? The more that Arab countries, and the most important ones, Saudis, the UAE, Egypt, cozy up to President Assad again, the more difficult it's going to be for the US to continue down that path.
Sebastian Usher. Pope Francis has been discharged from hospital after treatment for a respiratory condition. He says he'll take part in Palm Sunday's Mass at the Vatican. Jenny Hill reports from Rome.
A smiling Pope Francis leaned on a stick as he greeted well-wishers outside the Gemelli Hospital. He's been here since Wednesday, receiving antibiotic treatment for bronchitis. The Vatican said he'd resumed some work duties while still in hospital and had baptised a newborn baby, as well as sharing a pizza dinner with some of the doctors and nurses. Outside the clinic, the Pope also comforted a couple who'd lost their child overnight and signed the plaster cast of a young boy. He appeared relaxed, telling reporters that he hadn't been frightened and quipped, "I'm still alive."
Jenny Hill. New York is preparing itself for a media circus only Donald Trump could provoke. When he was US president, the news was certainly never dull, and his expected appearance in court on Tuesday will make headlines around the world. We know he faces criminal charges, and it's widely expected some relate to hush money paid to the porn star Stormy Daniels. Mr. Trump denies any wrongdoing. So, what's the mood in New York, and how have his supporters reacted? John Sudworth sent us this report from outside Trump Tower.
Do you think God doesn't see this?
Protest, protest, protest. Donald Trump urged his supporters a week or so ago. But now that the indictment is official, here outside Trump Tower, there's just one lonely, solitary protester holding up a handmade sign written in biro. What does your sign say?
Witch hunt. There's no law that Trump broke. There's no law.
What are you holding in that hand?
A King James Bible. Really? I know it sounds cheesy, but I am here because God sent me.
Why hasn't he sent anybody else, though?
Because God likes the foolish things.
While President Joe Biden refused to answer questions about the case, the Republican Party has rallied around Donald Trump, even some of those who may end up fighting him for the next presidential nomination, like his former Vice President Mike Pence.
Well, first, let me just say, I think the unprecedented indictment of a former president of the United States for a campaign finance issue is an outrage. And I think it's clear to the overwhelming majority of the American people that this is nothing short of a political prosecution.
The people of New York versus Donald J. Trump.
New details about the historic indictment of former president.
Tonight, what we have just learned in the indictment.
Beyond the made-for-TV spectacle of the first formal arrest of a former commander-in-chief, the longer-term political impact is uncertain. It may rally his base, of course, but so far, outside Trump Tower, it's still quiet. There is a man doing Trump impressions.
So I'm the only Donald Trump impersonator that does mime.
You mime Trump.
He points a lot. He does this.
The sort of OK sign, yeah.
That's the OK sign. This is a thumbs up sign.
You're now being indicted.
Well, not me. He is. And I'll tell you the truth. It's great publicity for me. I'm making more money because, first of all, the indictment is, however you want to look at it, if you're political or not, it's great press for him. And it's great press for me, so I can't complain.
For some supporters, the evidence surrounding the payment of hush money to a porn star known as Stormy Daniels may have the opposite effect. Here's Professor Stephen Gillers from the New York University School of Law.
People who may think that the whole thing's political now can begin to shift in their views as evidence emerges during a trial. Remember, people are now speaking about the legitimacy of this indictment before knowing what's in it.
It may, of course, be only the first of a number of cases Trump ends up facing. These are uncharted waters for a man long used to defying the normal rules, and a real test for America's institutions, too.
John Sutworth. One of the world's leading human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, has a new leader. She's 48-year-old Tarana Hassan, a lawyer and long-standing human rights investigator. Her appointment to the post marks a generational shift for the organization, founded in 1978 and led for the past three decades by Kenneth Roth. Tarana Hassan spoke to Paul Henley about her career leading up to this point, beginning in Adelaide in her adoptive country, Australia, when she was a final year law student and founded a group to represent refugees.
One day, the lawyer I was working with had received a report of a fire in the middle of the Australian desert. When he went out there, he found over 1,000 refugees and asylum seekers who had been locked away 600 kilometres away from the nearest big city, with no access to legal representation, living in pretty squalid situations. And these were people who had fled from Iraq, Iran and Afghanistan. And it was from there that we realised that Australia was trying to essentially hide these refugees, which they had picked up, who had arrived by boat and had detained them. So that was my first foray into not only working with refugees, but the very cruel policy that Australia was implementing at the time.
And how important do you think your background and your upbringing has been to bringing you to where you are now?
It shaped my view of the world. I am half Pakistani, quarter Sri Lankan, quarter Chinese, born in Singapore with this thick Australian accent. And the Australian accent is somewhat of an accident. My father was an academic and he wrote a book about Singapore's housing policy. My father then came under the ire of the Singapore government, and my parents had friends who were being picked up and being accused of various things, and they knew that my father was probably going to be next, and so they decided it would be better for us to leave, and so we went to Australia. And it's not that we sat around the dinner table having conversations about this, saying this was a human rights issue. And, you know, my mother is half Sri Lankan. And so when the war in Sri Lanka happened, we knew that we had relatives there. And again, we didn't frame it as a human rights challenge. But I grew up with this constant understanding that there is power in the world and that power can be misused. And the people who bear the brunt of that are people like you and me. I knew the importance also of what it meant when people stood up against that power, when people supported those in need. That must have led me down this path.
And as leader of a globally important organisation, you are a woman of colour from the global south. That's got to be progress.
I am all of those things. I'm a woman of colour who's had many years' experience in the human rights sector and working in conflict and crisis. I think that that has equipped me well to be able to understand what we do in a way that I hope will be able to support our staff who are out there, you know, in 100 countries around the world documenting abuses as they happen. So I think it's great to see that there is spaces for women particularly, but for all of those people with lived experience to be able to bring that to the table with the people that we work with, the survivors, the victims, the communities, but also the wider human rights movement. So it's an exciting moment in time.
Lawyer and long-standing human rights investigator Tarana Hassan. It's a role-playing, storytelling game that for years was looked down on as nerdy. But now it's having a moment, popularised in a Netflix series and at last made into a big Hollywood film, complete with cool actors and startling action. But the textbook arc of success that Dungeons & Dragons is enjoying has sprouted an unlikely addition. It's now also being used in therapy. Terry Egan has this report.
Here's the thing. We're a team of thieves.
And when you do this, you're bound to make enemies.
It's
sometimes those enemies.
An excerpt from the trailer for Honor Among Thieves, a film based on the Dungeons & Dragons game that was released on Friday. Dungeons & Dragons, or D&D, is a role-play game that more than 50 million people are estimated to have participated in since it was created in 1975. During the game, you can choose to be different characters and are confronted with challenges, forcing you to make decisions. And that is where therapy comes into play, combining fun and learning, the fantasy role-playing is being used as a form of treatment. One of the therapists is Dr. Megan Connell, a psychologist in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the author of a book, Tabletop Role-Playing Therapy, A Guide for the Clinician Game Master.
Role-playing is nothing new for therapy. We've been using role-playing for decades now. But there's always this hesitation for people to role-play because they're role-playing themselves. And there seems to be some magic when we give a client a character sheet and they get to role play as their character. And so they have that little bit of distance. And that seems to just really create this space where people can learn and thrive in what they're doing.
Therapeutic D&D is a burgeoning field. One Seattle-based psychologist uses the game to teach social skills to children on the autism spectrum. And while advocates maintain that no cinematic depiction of their world could compete with their imaginations, that's the very strength of this type of therapy. It can be used especially with people who have trouble sticking up for themselves or saying no, for instance. Yes, learning to be brave in the game, they can then learn to be brave in real life.
I wonder if he's a fan. That's Terry Egan there on Dungeons and Dragons. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by David Evans and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.